pretty good, actually. Is that better? Let's see. It might be worse. How about that? That's good.
When it's green, it's on, so then you can do testing.
Testing. All right. Is that good?
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
Now you should turn it off.
Is that good, Katie? Can you hear everything? Super. Welcome, everyone. My name is Lisa Falsco. I'm the CEO of the Alaska World Affairs Council, and welcome. We today have KSKA and KACN recording, so if you could please turn off your cell phones and wait for the microphone to be passed around during the Q&A portion so we can capture everything for our radio and our telephone listeners. Speaking of radio listeners, I'd like to thank William Toyer for doing this and Katie Parrish. And if you're at home right now listening on KSKA at the rebroadcast or if listening to KACN and haven't paid the $25 for lunch, please consider donating to these wonderful two organizations and thanking them for all the great work they do for our community. If this is your first Alaska World Affairs program, could you please raise your hand? Wonderful. Thank you so much. You are in for a treat. I have been lucky to follow around our two guest speakers as they went to KLEF this morning to talk on the radio and to West High School, where they spoke to about 50 International Baccalaureate students. And I'm pleased to be able to have the same type of program here today for all of you, where we get to listen to them have a discussion for about 40 minutes, and then we can ask questions at the end. If you are a student, if you could please stand and be recognized today. Wonderful. Thank you so very much for coming. And thank you to BP, our sponsor, for all of the student lunches. Makes it possible for students to come to the World Affairs Council programs at no cost. Thank you. I would like now to bring to the podium a celebrity in our town and former board member, Chancellor Tom Case. Chancellor Case.
Thank you, Lisa. I really don't consider myself a celebrity, but I appreciate the introduction. And thank you, Lisa, for recognizing the students in the audience. That's a very important part of this organization. I would also like to recognize and ask to stand all faculty and staff members from any university who's here today. Thank you very much. It is a real pleasure for me to be back in this forum for any number of reasons, not least of which is the vantage point that the top of the Hilton room provides of the beauties of Alaska and the sense of grandeur and size and scope, which relates very well in my experience with the importance of the topics that are discussed here. And that's meant very much to me over the years, starting when I served in the military command here in Alaska, continuing through the time that I really appreciated on the board of directors of Alaska World Affairs Council. A tremendously vibrant, important organization. And I would encourage any who are not members to seriously consider membership. Membership is important. By joining the Alaska World Affairs Council, you can play a direct role in helping us continue discussion on these important world topics like we have today. If you are a member, thank you. If not, we're here to help you with blue cards on the table to help you sign up for membership. And you can pay now or the World Affairs Council will contact you later. Now, to get to the exciting part of today's event, it's my pleasure and privilege to introduce our panel, Michael Thomas and Hussein Ibish. Michael Thomas is a retired attorney who spent 5 years in the Army and 24 years in private practice here in Alaska and Washington before returning to school, ultimately earning 2 degrees, including a PhD in international relations from the London School of Economics. He is author of The American Policy Towards Israel, The Power and Limits of Beliefs. The book analyzes domestic political influences on American policy towards Israel, including Jewish and Christian groups and presidential leadership. Hussein Ibish is a senior research fellow at the American Task Force on Palestine and the executive director of the Hollis Salam Maksoud Foundation for Arab American Leadership. He has also served as the communications director for the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, the largest Arab American membership organization in the United States. He is the editor and principal author of 3 major studies entitled Hate Crimes and Discrimination Against Arab Americans. His most recent book is titled What's Wrong with the One-Sided Agenda, One State Agenda, Why Ending the Occupation and Peace with Israel is Still the Palestinian National Goal. Here with us today, and we're very privileged to have these 2 panelists join us. So with that, gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Being an old trial lawyer, and I mean really old, former trial lawyer, I can't go anywhere without a notebook. And I have some notes to ask Hussein questions from, and a few setup sentences before I get to questions. Reviewing them, I know I'm not going to get to all the questions by any means, and so we're going to try to jump to the more important things. We will try to go 40 minutes and then get to your questions because that's more interesting to us and more important to you. First kind of thing I want to talk about is this is the month that the PLO is going to the United Nations. In less than 2 weeks, in fact, the UN General Assembly plenary session starts, and Mahmoud Abbas of the Palestinian Authority and the head of the PLO has said that the PLO is going to the UN to either or both ask the Security Council to admit Palestine a state as a member of the UN, or to the General Assembly to get enhanced status as a state observer. They're currently an observer organization. The U.S. has threatened to veto the resolution of the Security Council, cut off funds to the PA if any effort is made in the General Assembly to get any enhanced status. Chair of the House Foreign Relations Committee is sponsoring legislation to cut funding to any U.N. body that grants the PLO any enhanced status. Some members of the Netanyahu government have said that all commitments under the Oslo Accords would be considered at an end if the PLO did what they say would be a unilateral act, which would mean the end of the Palestinian Authority, and or that they would annex the West Bank. Now, these are not official Israeli government statements. I heard a presentation by Main Erekat Hussein, the PLO diplomatic representative of the U.S., a couple of weeks ago, and to be honest, I couldn't discern a clear strategic plan by the PLO or any plan for the day after a U.N. vote, whatever the outcome of that vote was. I want to combine a couple of questions here. How do you see the realistic options for the PLO and the U.N.? As far as you can tell, is there a plan? If so, what? And what's at stake in doing this?
Okay. Well, let's talk first for a second about why they're doing it. They're doing it out of absolute desperation and frustration because the PLO and the PA, the mainstream secular nationalist Palestinian leadership, has doubled and tripled and quadrupled down on a strategy, a national strategy of achieving independence and statehood in the occupied territories, a Palestinian state to live alongside Israel in peace and security, through a combination of negotiations with Israel, international diplomacy, and institution building in the West Bank. And if the Palestinian public concludes that these policies have failed finally and irrevocably and permanently, they will look for an alternative leadership, and there is a competitor national leadership candidate which is currently in control of Gaza and has support in a significant minority of Palestinian society, that is Hamas. So the PLO has a very powerful, and the PA have a very powerful stake in trying to move the ball forward, but we're stuck. We've been stuck since February, and actually even before, since the direct talks broke down last year. So, and there's been no sign of any real concrete effort that had any chance of resuscitating those negotiations. So they feel desperate. And you have to understand, while there are a lot of Americans and Israelis and Europeans and Arabs who are frustrated by the impasse, Palestinians are uniquely so find the situation intolerable. The status quo is unbearable to them because they are a people living under foreign military occupation without human or national rights and in a situation of discrimination and repression that is unparalleled anywhere in the world. They are not citizens of any state, the state that rules them or any other state. That's quite an extraordinary thing for millions of people. It doesn't exist anywhere else in the world, especially when you're talking about a population mainly that is not refugees, the population in the occupied territories. So they came with this idea of shifting the discussion to the multilateral form of the UN out of a kind of desperation. Now, I've been asking people in the PLO and others from the beginning, what exactly are you talking about? What precisely are you going to do in September? And I have never received a clear answer. You say you listened to Ma'an Arakat and you couldn't discern a clear strategy. Well, I haven't had a clear strategy from in any conversations, private or public, that I've heard. I've heard a lot of ideas, but I don't know exactly what they're going to do. There are basically three options. First, they could go to the Security Council and ask for full UN membership, but they know very well what will happen. The United States will veto it. This has been made clear, and in fact, yesterday officially announced. So there's absolutely no doubt that that would be a losing confrontation with the United States on the question of statehood in the Security Council. And they need to bear in mind, the last time they had a losing confrontation with the United States in the Security Council, which was last February, over a resolution on settlements, since which Israel has had, which was vetoed by the United States, and after which Israel had more or less a free hand on settlements with very little protest. So, you know, to repeat that on the issue of statehood in the Security Council carries huge risks. The second option they have is to either do that and incur the veto or simply bypass the Security Council altogether and go to the General Assembly and ask for non-member observer state status. Now they could get that because that requires a simple majority, and they clearly have that. The great appeal of that is that historically, that apart from the Vatican, which is currently the only non-member observer state in the General Assembly, there have been 16 non-member observer states. And if you account for the unification of North and South Vietnam and East and West Germany, all 16 are now full member states. So this historical precedent is very appealing to the Palestinians. However, there is a very strong chance that while they would get a very large majority of Asian, African, and Latin American votes in favor of that, most Western countries would probably vote against it. And that the Israelis would then be able to claim, either implicitly or even explicitly, that sure, the Third World and the non-aligned movement supports Palestine, but the important countries, the OECD countries, the West and Japan and the United States, they support us, and they didn't support this resolution, and they could claim a kind of victory. They could claim, you know, the civilized world supports us. So there, and there's the potential for really serious retaliation. You mentioned the possibility of a cutoff of U.S. aid. The Palestinians require between $1.2 and $1.5 billion in foreign aid every year, and a lot of that goes to meet payroll. About 1 million Palestinians are directly dependent on the PA payroll. And the PA also pays most of the public payroll in Gaza, as well as the West Bank. And then, of course, there's the circulation of that money within the economy, beyond the 1 million people who are directly dependent on those salaries. And the U.S. contributes approximately $400 million of that between 1.2 and 1.5 billion. So it's a very significant amount of money, and there's a lot at stake. Israel has also threatened retaliation, withholding Palestinian tax revenues and all the things you talked about. So you, in this case, it would be a symbolic victory with very significant real costs attached. So they have to be very careful about that. There is the third option, which is that what they're currently pursuing, which is trying to find language, working with the Europeans, working with the quartets that would advance their diplomatic position, maybe without changing their status from the PLO observer mission to a state, an observer state, but an enhancements and statements clarifying that the borders have to be based on the 1967 lines and reiterating a lot of what President Obama said and making it clear that the international community will not accept anything other than an end to the occupation as the outcome, coupled with, you know, more aid and more support. That's the third option. I think in many ways that's the preferred option, because otherwise you're talking about a scenario that carries with it a lot of risks for all the parties, including for the Palestinians.
Let me ask you a couple of connected questions from the U.S. perspective. Why does the Obama administration want so strongly to stay out of the U.N.? What's at stake for the U.S. if it has to use its veto, presumably against the votes of at least some friends and Arab states as well? Why can't the United States seem to get the quartet to come into line? There were quartet meetings that were scheduled and then canceled because there wasn't any agreement to be had. And then there was one held on July 11th where we were all anticipating that there was going to be a communique expressing what the quartet thought about all this. And they clearly were unable to come to any agreement. So, from the U.S. perspective, what's the calculation in making the statements and positions they have?
I'll go in reverse order here. You're absolutely right. The last time the quartet met, they were unable to issue a statement, and it was because the quartet is the United States, the UN Secretariat, the European Union, and the Russian Federation. And really, the role of the quartet, in fact, you know, de facto, is to provide international imprimatur to American-led negotiation efforts, to the American brokered bilateral negotiations and other efforts the U.S. has been making. And they were not able to issue a statement for the first time since the formation of the quartet. And it was over the question of whether the Palestinians should be asked to recognize Israel as a, open quote, Jewish state, close quote, whatever that might mean. I mean, I really think the Palestinian response to this demand, that this new demand that was never heard of until the Annapolis meeting of 2007, that they somehow recognize Israel as an open quote Jewish state, close quote, the correct response from the Palestinians should be, please provide us a detailed definition of what that means. What do you mean a Jewish state? I'm not sure what it means. I don't believe Israelis have any consensus about what it means. And I think Palestinians are entitled to know what exactly it is they're being asked to recognize before they decide whether to recognize it or not. And I think that's absolutely the right answer. But the United States wanted the quartet statement to reflect that position, and the rest of the quartet wouldn't agree. So it was a 3-to-1 split, which makes it even more uncomfortable for the United States. The great problem here with what the Palestinians are doing is twofold from the Obama administration's point of view. And the first is that it's seen, and it's often said by Israel and the United States, that this is unilateral. Well, of course it's not unilateral. Nothing that happens at the UN is unilateral. It's multilateral. The UN is a multilateral body, and things that happen in the UN are not unilateral. They're multilateral. But it is outside the context of the American brokered bilateral relations. So in that sense, it looks unilateral. It's outside the process. The process that we have been brokering and controlling since 1993. Now, I think that there is a charitable and an uncharitable reading of the American interest in preserving that process and discouraging any shift to a multilateral forum. And they're both true. The uncharitable reading is that we want to control the process, and if we're brokering it, then we have control, and if it goes into forums like the General Assembly of the United Nations, where the whole thing began with the Partition Resolution in 1947 and the acceptance of Israel as a member state in 1949, then we would have a lot less control. And you know, in that sense, it's preserving the prerogatives of the power of the United States. There is a more charitable reason that is also true to some extent, which is that actually there is no other body or group of powerful countries or coalition of powerful countries that are really volunteering to broker the whole thing. I mean, you could pass a resolution recognizing Palestine as a non-member observer state, but that doesn't create the Palestinian state. It's a virtual thing. That's a rhetorical device. There is no other candidate other than the United States to broker the process of negotiating the creation of a Palestinian state that really can only be achieved through an agreement between Palestinians and Israel. And Israel is the occupying power that cannot be militarily defeated, and therefore they will have to agree to the creation of a Palestinian state if in the foreseeable future one is to emerge. That means, as President Abbas keeps saying, we know we have to go back to negotiations. I think everyone who's serious about ending the conflict and ending the occupation knows that's what has to happen. Now, if the United States is really the only country that's interested in doing it, France would like to, but the rest of the EU doesn't. And France on its own can't. And nobody else has a remote interest in playing this role. And also, there's a real question of whether Israel would be interested in participating in a process in which they didn't feel the patron and protector, the United States, was centrally involved. So there's a charitable and an uncharitable reason, and I think they're both true.
In a New York Times op-ed this spring, Mahmoud Abbas set out why it was an option that they felt like they had to do to go to the UN.
Yeah, that was the May 16th op-ed, right?
Right. And in the course of that op-ed, he mentioned that membership in the United Nations would give Palestine standing in the ICC under the Rome Treaty, the International Criminal Court. And it's unclear whether anything short of membership in the United Nations would give a state that standing. The Rome Statute doesn't require UN membership for standing, but the prosecutor has been waffling on what does constitute enough evidence of statehood.
Right.
So it's possible that the General Assembly resolution that we mentioned might also persuade the prosecutor, but we don't know. Under the Rome Statute, illegal settlement of occupied territory is a crime.
It's a war crime, in fact.
So how much of a factor is this, as best you can tell, in Palestinian thinking, and how much of a factor is it in Israeli and American thinking in terms of the vociferousness of the response?
I don't think it's a big factor in American thinking. I think it's a huge factor in Israeli thinking. I think Israelis feel very, very vulnerable about the ICC because the Statute of Rome has three vulnerabilities for Israel. One, any belligerent power that's involved in conflicts could be potentially liable for unlawful attacks on civilians, property, or use of certain weapons like white phosphorus, for example, other things that Israel and any belligerent power in a conflict might be vulnerable to. So that's one. More importantly, you're absolutely right. Settlement activity is defined as a war crime. And there is no question that Israel is the occupying power, and there is no question that East Jerusalem, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip are occupied. The Security Council has ruled on that definitively scores of times since 1967. So the Israeli position, most recently and publicly outlined by Deputy Foreign Minister Ayalon in his hilarious YouTube video, in which he claimed there's no occupation and nothing of the kind, and this is ridiculous, and there's no Palestine. It was an absurdity, frankly. He is alone in his opinion. He's entitled to his opinion, but we have an arbiter in the world, and it's the UN Security Council, and they've made the fact, the legal and political fact, that East Jerusalem, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip are occupied, and that Israel is the occupying power. That can be asserted as a legal and political fact. You can have an opinion that the sky is green if you like, but there are such a thing in this world as legal and political facts, and when the Security Council rules on this time and again, it's a fact. So the settlement activity being a war crime, Israel is obviously vulnerable. There's a third thing, which a lot of people don't know about, but the Israelis sure do, which is another war crime under the Statute of Rome, which is the crime of apartheid, which means a system of ethnic or sectarian discrimination by one group against another for purposes of privileging that group with the intention of perpetuating it. Now, the only thing about the system of complete separate and unequal status that Israel operates in the occupied territories that could possibly get them out of potential liability for the crime of apartheid is this idea that maybe they're not doing it with the intention of perpetuating it. But, you know, 40 years is a long time, and moving from zero settlers to 500,000 settlers indicates some indication of perpetuation, of an intention. You could make a case that there's a prima facie suggestion of intent to perpetuate. So they're very concerned. The Palestinians tried to accede to the Statute of Rome and didn't succeed on the grounds that they weren't a state and on the grounds that the territory of the PA wasn't clear. Israelis can't be prosecuted by the ICC on the basis of their nationality because they're not a party to the statute. And they can't be prosecuted for anything that happens in Israel because they're not a party. But if Palestine were a member state of the United Nations, a full member state of the United Nations, and acceded to the statute, then Israel would be liable for anything that it did in the occupied territories if it was clear that the occupied territories were under the jurisdiction of the Palestinian state, full state member. It's totally unclear, as you say, under the statute, what the status of an observer, non-member observer state would be. And I'm a little skeptical that an observer state, a virtual state, I know, recognized by the General Assembly would be able to accede to the Statute of Rome, and that the prosecutors would act because the territory under the jurisdiction of this virtual state would still be probably, it is likely that any resolution that would pass would be leave it unclear as to exactly what territory belonged to that state, and the state being virtual, I'm a little dubious that the Israelis will actually face prosecution at this point in time. But they are very vulnerable and they are very concerned, and it's certainly something Palestinians have talked a lot about, particularly in private, but also sometimes in public, yes.
And even international lawyers can scare people sometimes. So.
Well, absolutely. And there isn't a consensus on this. There's a big debate about this. The whole thing is being debated among a whole bunch of international lawyers. Guy Goodwin Gill, Francis Boyle, Camille Mansour, a whole group of international attorneys are having a big fight about the implications of this vis-a-vis of the ICC and vis-a-vis the idea of replacing the PLO, which has a certain international status and structure and responsibilities and institutions and whatnot, with a new entity, a state that doesn't have any of those things, and what effect that would have on Palestinian rights and whatnot.
And at this point, it doesn't really make any difference what the opinions of all these people are. It's an issue. It's a scary issue.
Right.
And if there is action taken in the UN, depending upon what that action is, it's more or less probable that courts are going to be asked to deal with it.
That's right.
I want to ask you, Hossein, I want to ask you, please, ask you one brief final question on this, and then I want to go on to something else. Palestinians, including Nabil Shaath, used to say that the U.S.-Israeli relationship, which is very strong, and the relationship of the U.S. with the PA was best for the peace process. The UN move is, depending on how you count, at least the third major move against U.S. advice this year.
That's right.
The UN, the Security Council resolution on settlements in February, the reconciliation agreement with Hamas, which was certainly over the objections of the United States, although Russia loved it. Is this, and then now into the September move. Is this a lasting turn away from reliance on the United States?
I don't know. I doubt it. It depends a lot on what happens. We could have a soft landing here, in the sense that we could have the development of language for the General Assembly that the United States, Israel, and some other Western countries are not fully comfortable with, and maybe they don't vote for, maybe they even vote against it, but they don't overreact, say, by cutting funds to the PA, destroying the ability of the PA to maintain hope and dignity among Palestinians by paying their salaries, to maintain the security services in the West Bank, and the there's a security cooperation with Israel that has reduced crime and terrorism in the West Bank, things like that, that would really create a soft landing as opposed to a hard landing. All of that is possible, but it's also possible that we could see a very large confrontation followed by an eruption of public anger in the occupied territories, because Palestinians are naturally, and as any group of people put in that situation would be, unbelievably frustrated with the fact that they've been negotiating their independence for more than 15 years and they're not getting anywhere. In fact, the number during the era of the peace process, which began in 1993, the number of settlers during the active part of the peace process from 93 to 98, when it was supposed to be resolved and the Palestinian state was supposed to be created, the number of settlers doubled from 200,000 to 400,000. It has now expanded to 500,000. The prospect of a viable independent Palestine appears to be whittling away with every new settlement, and there have been very provocative new settlement announcements, including Har Homasi, which threatens to almost complete a ring of settlements around East Jerusalem, cutting it off from the west, rest of the West Bank, expansions in various places deep into the West Bank. And it's obviously a situation that's extremely, extremely difficult. But in the end, because there isn't, a viable alternative at this stage to an American brokered negotiation process, this has to ultimately be a way of demonstrating that Palestinians have options, that they're not entirely dependent on a system that requires Israeli enthusiasm and forthcomingness and American determination, that they have agency. This is the origin of this, the need to show that they can't simply be told, look, your issue's on the back burner, and by the way, the settlements are going forward, and hey, sorry, you know, that they can actually do things to make life uncomfortable, yes, for themselves, but also for Israel, and for the United States, and for everybody, and that people had better do something about this, that it is not a tolerable, tenable situation. Now, what they want, and they keep saying so, and I'm sure they believe it, because they know there's no other way, is to resume negotiations. President Abbas yesterday said, our first, second, and third choice is negotiations. And he said, whatever happens in the UN is not against negotiations. We will always return to negotiations. In the end, the state will be created by negotiations. Now, that, I think, is a recognition of a fundamental reality, which is that there isn't any other way to actually create that state. And the second reality is there isn't an alternative international power to broker it other than the United States. So I think that as long as Palestinians are seeking to create an independent state through diplomacy and institution building, they will continue to have, you know, look to American leadership ultimately to help deliver Israel.
All right, thank you.
But if they turn away from it, then no.
All right. My prediction that we'd never get through the questions is absolutely turning out to be true. I want to turn to another subject, which is the institution building program of Prime Minister Fayyad. Hmm. He announced 2 years ago the PA was planning to build the institutions of a state by this month.
Right.
World Bank and a UN group responsible for dealing with Palestine have concluded that the PA is, quote, well positioned for the establishment of a state at any point in the near future, unquote.
Yeah.
Israelis responsible for security have acknowledged that they're able to rely on the PA security forces trained by the U.S. and Jordan. So, how has Fayyad's program gone over with Palestinians, and how does it relate to the current plans to approach the UN? Secondly, Fayyad did not initially link this program to any plan to declare statehood unilaterally or to seek UN membership. Has the success of the program, however, now become so interdependent on the success of those ideas that they go together or they fall together? Oh. And what happens to the Fayyad program if Palestine doesn't achieve UN membership or the UN recognition of statehood?
Very interesting, complicated. I'll try to be as brief as possible. I really will. But that is a hell of a question. Actually, from the outset, you know, when the Palestinian cabinet first adopted the state and institution building program in August of 2009. It was received in Washington as a development program and was kind of sent to USAID. And I was saying, and my colleagues and I went blue in the face telling everybody, this is not a development program. This is political, this is strategic, this is national, this is international. This needs to be treated with the utmost seriousness. This is not something for USAID, this is for state and NSC, okay? And that finally got understood. And so from the beginning, there was a link in the minds of Fayyad and the rest of the PA cabinet, between the institution building and the development of the state. And the word, the operative word, has been convergence. What they've been looking for, and what hasn't happened yet, is convergence between the progress that's been made, that's been very significant, but also in certain ways quite limited on the ground. Significant because they've created a lot of the main institutions of a state. Limited because it's restricted to Area A, mainly, which is 15% of the West Bank. And restricted because there's still a lot of work to be done, say, for instance, in the reforming the court system. There's a lot of, it's a work in progress, that's for sure. The convergence they were hoping for was between that work on the so bottom up work on the ground with diplomacy top down. At the international register led by the PLO. And they were hoping these two things would converge and provide momentum for the creation of a state, and that hasn't happened. And the other thing that they had in mind was that when diplomacy is stalled, when the political process is unable to go forward, the institution building can be another source of momentum because it does change facts on the ground. You could think of it as the Palestinian answer to Israeli settlement activity. Unilateral changes on the ground, but in this case, unlike with settlement activity, legal and consistent with the goal of a two-state solution, rather than illegal and contradictory to the goal of a two-state solution. Palestinians, in a sense, saying, calling everyone's bluff. Their own bluff is, if you're serious about a state, you build it. Israel's bluff, if you're serious about having a Palestinian state, you must allow us to create its infrastructure. Calling the West and the Arabs' bluff, you want us to have a state, help us pay for it, because we're under occupation, we're not a normal people with normal income, and you have to help us. It called everyone's bluff, and in its own terms, it was very successful. The future of it depends enormously on not having a catastrophic confrontation at the UN, which is what you implied. Now, if American aid were cut off, if the Israelis withheld Palestinian tax revenue that they collect and that they then deliver to the Palestinians, and Steinmetz, the finance minister, keeps saying he wants to hold this money back, the PLO, the PA's ability to continue with its program will be absolutely crippled. Even their ability to meet payroll will be crippled. They paid half salaries 2 months ago. This next month, they're paying paying half salaries. And again, that's also public employees in Gaza as well. So it is potentially destructive to that program. And that's why I think whatever happens in September, it is essential that funding to the Palestinians continue. This idea of punishing the Palestinians by cutting off their money and cutting off money to the UN and cutting off and cutting off and cutting off will take a difficult situation and make it potentially unmanageable. It is the worst idea I've ever heard in my life.
All right. And I was going to ask you about the why, wherefore, and future of the reconciliation agreement with Hamas. But we're gonna
give you a 30-second answer.
No, you're not okay. Gonna do that.
I said I could.
You're not gonna do that.
I said I could.
Because
I
right now we are overdue for okay. Q&A from the
that's
audience,
fine.
And I'm sure that somebody's gonna ask that question.
Okay,
aren't you?
That's fine. That will be one of the shortest answers.
All right. Could you if you want to ask a question, could you raise your hand, wait for the microphone, please state your name and state a question, not a speech. Thank you.
My name is David Abouay.
Oh. Yeah.
My name is David Abouay. I would like him to answer the question you just answered.
Oh, okay. I don't hold out much hope in the foreseeable future for the National Reconciliation Agreement actually being acted on. Because I think that both, it's really it's supposedly a PLO-Hamas agreement, but it's really a Fatah-Hamas agreement. And the reasons that they agreed were that they felt pressure to agree. First, Fatah lost one of its closest allies in President Mubarak and became extremely nervous about the position that left them in vis-a-vis the new Egypt and its possible relationship with Gaza and Hamas. And then Hamas had an even bigger shock when their relations with President Assad in Syria collapsed completely. And their Politburo is based there, and they're reliant on their relationship with al-Assad. And now they're even talking, Mahmoud Zahar, who was their foreign minister for a very senior figure in Gaza, is saying, we have to move, we have to relocate, we cannot stay in Syria. The position of all Palestinians in Syria, and specifically, he didn't say this, but I'll add Hamas, is untenable in Syria at the moment. So he even mentioned moving to Cairo and whatnot. And so this sudden sort of shift was based on the loss of these allies by these two parties. But also, whereas in the rest of the Arab Spring, the Arab uprisings, the call has been for regime change, democracy, reform, resignation of presidents, etc., among Palestinians, both in Gaza and the West Bank, it was for national unity. That's what the young people and the ordinary people were demonstrating for in March and in April, etc. And that was the demand. So there was an agreement to make an agreement, but they have not been able to agree on anything, as a matter of fact. They agreed to release prisoners, but they haven't done it. And I just think that there is no real possibility of an actual activated reconciliation between these two parties because they do not agree on anything, virtually at all, except the concept of Palestine and that they're all Palestinians. But anything specific, they really don't agree on anything. And they are in competition for leadership of the national movement. And fitting the square peg into the round hole seems to me right now impossible. I think eventually one side is going to prevail, one vision is going to prevail, and that will determine the future. I don't think there's going to be a deal that's actuated along those lines, I'm afraid.
Thank you. Brian Davies, I want to go back to your discussion of the relevance of some form of recognition of a Palestinian state and its impact on the question of the occupation and the vulnerability of Israel to that. And I don't quite follow it, because it's clear that the territory is being occupied.
Yes.
It was once Jordan, I believe.
No, it was administered. But the West Bank was administered by Jordan, Gaza was administered by Egypt. The Jordanians had some kind of annexation, but they've renounced it, and really it was administered by Jordan.
So that is why Jordan could not make the case that and take it to...
Jordan has renounced all claims on the West Bank and East Jerusalem. formally. They'll never. They would actually fight not to have any. It is Egyptian priority. It is the single biggest aspect of Egyptian foreign policy not to be drawn back into Gaza under any circumstances.
So this is a piece of land which is probably unique, with no ownership.
Well, legally speaking, you're right. There is no sovereign. It was administered by the British until May 15th, 1948. And then different bits of it were administered by Arab countries, and then it has been occupied, the rest of it, East Jerusalem, West Bank, Gaza Strip, occupied by Israel since 1967, so there is no lawful sovereign. However, there is an international consensus, including a Security Council resolution from the Bush era, from I think it was 2004, 2005, that says there should be a Palestinian state in that territory. In fact, there is, from a moral point of view and certain legal arguments, there is a sovereign there, which is the people, the majority. The Palestinians who live there. They have a right to self-determination under many different aspects of international law, and in that sense, there is a suppressed sovereign, which is the people of the land.
Could I please add,
by all means,
add just a couple of things? Eugene Rostow, when he was the dean of the Yale Law School, took the idea that you just expressed and talked about it as the case of the missing reversioner, i.e. there's nobody to give the land back to.
Yeah.
And he thereby argued that the Fourth Geneva Convention didn't apply, right?
Yeah.
That argument, in fact, was made by one of the top legal officials in Israel very early on. They haven't made it since. Almost all legal scholars say that that's not right, and it isn't right for the basic reason. I mean, you can get into the details, but the basic reason is the Fourth Geneva Convention was intended to protect the rights of residents of the land, inhabitants, right? Not the rights of a state,
right?
Right, and that is the conclusion that is reached by probably the world's greatest expert on military occupation, what's called belligerent occupation under the Fourth Geneva Convention and other customary international law, and that is Professor Yoram Dinstein, who is Israeli and who has written a whole book on this subject. Okay, so it isn't like you can't make an argument, it's just that it has been made and essentially roundly rejected.
Yeah. And we have all the Security Council resolutions as well.
So. That's right, yeah.
Paul Dunscombe, University of Alaska Anchorage. Actually, sort of a two-part question. One is just sort of on a more macro level. What does the Arab Spring mean for this process?
Ah.
Or if anything?
Mm.
And you talked about the tensions within the Palestinians themselves over who shall lead them. Are there any similar fissures existing in Israel at this time?
Yeah, very interesting. Well, I think there's a lot of fissures in Israel, and in fact, you have a cabinet that's an ideological crazy quilt. It makes no sense at all from a policy point of view, but everyone gets the minimum they need. Prime Minister Netanyahu gets to be Prime Minister, even though Tzipi Livni has one more seat than he does, so he doesn't even have the biggest party in Knesset, yet he is the Prime Minister. Avigdor Lieberman gets to be Foreign Minister, even though they don't let him go out very much and prefer to send Danny Ayalon because he's a little bit more presentable. But he has his big piece of the pie, and he has a big party, the Russian tribal party or immigrant party or however you want to put it. Shas gets the interior ministry where they get the money for their social programs, which is why they formed their party in the first place. And Ehud Barak left Labor, and he's still sort of the liaison between the garrison state military and the political sphere, because he's probably the only person in the cabinet that the generals respect, and they think they may not like him. He did. Gabi Ashkenazi didn't like him, but they respected him, and they speak the same language. I mean, when they tried to have the labor leader, Peretz as defense minister that they just couldn't talk to. They didn't speak the same language. And I don't think there's anybody else in the Israeli cabinet who could really talk to the generals. So, anyway, so there are fissures. The biggest fissure at the moment, though it is remarkable that this crazy quilt cabinet in Israel is one of the most stable coalitions in the history of Israel. Because everybody gets the minimum they need, and because the opposition is very divided and is led by a leader who is not charismatic and who has not been using the tools that are available to her. All these generals and ex-generals and national security people saying, no, we must have a deal, we must make peace. She's not using them. I don't understand her strategy at all. Anyway, she's not a very effective opposition leader. I'll simply say that. And so far, maybe she'll grow into the job eventually. The big fissure right now is the fight over who is going to be king of the right in Israel, Netanyahu or Lieberman. And in my opinion, this business about whether to apologize to Turkey or not has nothing to do with apologizing to Turkey, because either of them on their own would apologize to Turkey the way they apologize to Egypt, just say, well, yeah, we're sorry and we hope it doesn't happen again. It's easy to do, it doesn't really cost you anything, all this stuff about we have to be strong, this is the Middle East, not rubbish. It's that if either one did it, they would crucify the other one in public with the right, and they can't afford that. There's this very strong tension between Netanyahu and Lieberman about who will be the king of the Israeli right. So far, Netanyahu's winning. But, you know, he's being harassed constantly from his right by Lieberman. Now, the other part of your question had to do with, remind me. The Arab Spring, yeah. Very important. Very, very important. The Arab uprisings are not about Palestine directly. They're about internal matters. This is misconstrued radically by many people, some deliberately and some out of ignorance, as suggesting that the centrality of the issue of Palestine for the Arabs has been a red herring all along, an excuse for governments to justify their incompetence and repression, etc. And it has been used that way, no doubt about it, and exploited it most ruthlessly by the Al-Assads, both father and son, but everybody. But the truth is that for Arabs of all nationalities, social classes, religions, etc., the Palestinian experience is the prism of pain through which international relations is viewed. Everything that happens in international relations is viewed through that lens, especially when it involves the United States, right? And what people need to understand is that Arabs can walk and chew gum at the same time. Right? They can care about their own freedom and object to dictatorship and still care about the occupation and still care about Palestinian national rights, and very passionately so, and return to it. And I mean, there is a mob right now outside the Israeli embassy in Egypt. I don't know if you know about that, but right now there is a mob outside the Israeli embassy, okay? And when the Israelis shot six Egyptian soldiers in this fight in Eilat, or in the hot pursuit after the fight in Eilat, presumably by accident, they had to issue a really serious apology. And I think it's true that the Israelis need to move quickly to restore their relations with a new Egypt. They have to have a different relationship. This is not your father's or your grandfather's Mubarak's Egypt. This is an Egypt where, yes, is ruled by the army for now, but they're more responsive to public opinion. And that's going to be true across the board. Now, that has two effects. One is it means that it makes life more difficult for the Israelis, because they have to deal with a public opinion that probably is going to be tougher on them than some of their Arab friends have been in the past. But it also means that whatever agreements they make are with more stable regimes, more stable societies. You can make an agreement between governments, but you can only sustain a peace between peoples. And so in that sense, the Arab Spring is very, very important. It is changing the landscape, and hopefully, and it should be, for the better.
Another question.
So if the consensus has been that ultimately there has to be a two-state solution, is the main argument now that the Palestinians went and asserted it on their own? Or is it arguments over what land is going to be included? Or is it arguments over Abbas versus Hamas? Mm. Which of those things? And then a second question, yeah, I have is, what is the viewpoint of the Israeli peace groups like Shalom Achshav and things, groups like that, regarding the UN resolution?
Well, they seem, the Israeli peace groups and the American Jewish sort of pro-peace organizations seem very torn about it. A lot of the Israeli peace groups have been silent on the issue. They haven't made much of a statement. A lot of them have made private, they haven't issued formal statements on behalf of the organization. They've written op-eds in which they've said, listen, this has been mishandled. If we had welcomed this, it would be a reaffirmation of Israeli statehood. And we would say we support Palestinian statehood in theory, and a member said, and then we have to negotiate the boundaries, and then that's fine. That's the official position. So what's wrong with that? Well, what's wrong with it is that really there are too many people in the present Israeli cabinet who are just not comfortable with the kind of concessions, the kind of agreements that would have to be made in order to make a two-state solution work. I believe the present is, and I think the Israeli peace groups also believe, the present Israeli cabinet just doesn't believe that it has too many people in it who don't believe that a peace agreement is either necessary or achievable or both. Now, that is the position of the foreign minister. Of Foreign Minister Lieberman. And every time he says it, the Prime Minister has to say he doesn't support, he doesn't represent the state, which is really strange. Another nice tidbit about Mr. Lieberman is he's a settler, which means that he's the only foreign minister who doesn't live in the country he represents, which is quite extraordinary. But there are enough people in that cabinet, and about something like a third of the MKs are in some way or another in that cabinet, in some position. And it's just it's very difficult to see them agreeing to this. So the objection, I think, at this point is that the Israelis are not ready to make the kind of concessions that would move the ball forward. And the Palestinians, too, have mishandled several issues, including the settlement issue, which they focused on in... they followed the American lead on it, but they really... It was unwise. They should not have focused on the settlement. They should have focused on the border issue. The settlement issue is a subset of... The settlement issue is not a final status issue. It's a subset of two final status issues. From the Palestinian point of view, it's a subset of the border issue. From the Israeli point of view, it's a subset of the security issue. But by focusing on this symptom of two other bigger things to the exclusion of what really is at stake, border and security, they made a big error. Now, I think the real objection to the Palestinian move is that it puts the United States, Israel, and some of the Western countries in a very awkward situation. It calls their bluff in a way that makes people very uncomfortable. And this is not the process that was agreed to, and therefore it is seen as going too far, too fast. There is a possibility for Palestinians to come up with a language that is more modest, that does not provoke an overreaction, and that is intended to be part of a series of resolutions that every year or every second year they go back to the General Assembly again and again and again and keep ratcheting it up bit by bit, salami style, rather than asking for the whole, the whole sausage all at once. And that, I think, is something they should consider very carefully, because the real costs, as opposed to the virtual benefits of pushing a major confrontation, don't add up to me.
Hi, Kelly Shannon from the University of Alaska Anchorage.
A little louder, please.
Kelly Shannon from the University of Alaska Anchorage. My question has to do with how serious you think the U.S. government's threats are to punish the Palestinian government. It would appear to me that would work against America's stated goals to try to foster a better relationship with the Arab world in general. Now, it's not unheard of for the U.S. to pursue contradictory policies, but I wonder if the Obama administration would actually follow through on some of these threats, or if it's more kind of posturing.
Yeah, I mean, I very much doubt that the Obama administration, look, if the Obama administration is forced to issue a veto in the Security Council, they will be very upset, and they will want to express that annoyance. I do not believe they will do it by seeking to cut funding to the PA, especially to the security services, but also to the authority generally, etc. I don't know how they'll express their annoyance, but they will. I think it's unlikely that they will be put in that situation. I don't actually think that's going to happen. I think the Palestinians, whatever they do, is much more likely to begin in the General Assembly, and that might produce annoyance as well. It is Congress that is the problem. It is Ileana Ros-Lehtinen, the chairwoman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, who is pushing this idea of defunding not only the PA, but also the UN and any international agency that gives any additional recognition to any form of Palestine or Palestinians in any way whatsoever under any circumstances at all.
And Hussein, it's also true that the Senate resolution backing a sanction of defunding, cutting the funding to the PA as opposed to the UN, had 87 co-sponsors,
right,
and essentially no opposition. And so, if you're, you know, if you're thinking, oh, it's the House,
no, it's the whole Congress, and
we are talking about appropriated funds here. It isn't just a pure foreign policy decision by the president. So.
No, that's right. It's a serious issue, which is another reason why I don't think there'll be an actual application to the Security Council, because that really was what the Senate resolution was talking about. Here's the thing. If the United States is perceived as being the primary agent blocking what most Arabs would regard as and what most people in the world actually would regard as a very reasonable request on the part of the Palestinians for, say, observer non-member state status, it puts us in a very difficult situation in many ways, not least of which it threatens to reverse the gains we've made with Arab public opinion in the past year. Traditionally, most Arab public opinion has regarded the United States as being interested in only two things with regard to the Middle East, which is, you know, since the end of the Cold War, the most important part of the world outside of the borders of the United States for us strategically. I think that's fair to say, because of the importance of the oil resources of the Persian Gulf. Most Arabs have perceived the United States to be interested in only two things: oil, you know, securing the flow and pricing and whatnot of the oil, and the security of Israel. And that because of that, the United States has been the champion of all the or most of the Arab dictators and monarchies, totally disinterested in Arab human rights, Arab democracy, the rights of not only Palestinians, but Syrians and Egyptians and Saudis and what have you. And this has been the reputation, that we are the great imperial status quo power, preserving the status quo, this unjust, unfair, repressive status quo at all costs. Now, this narrative has been dealt a very serious blow in the past 12 months, because the United States ended up siding with the people against the dictatorship in Egypt, a little slow, but took the right stance, very much so in Libya, I mean, majorly so, and I think Obama can very soon be able to claim to add the scalp of Muammar al-Gaddafi to the scalp of Osama bin Laden, and it's going to be very difficult for Republicans to harass him on national security and foreign policy in the election. They're lucky that it's likely to be about the economy anyway, and nobody's going to care about anything else other than jobs and such. And in Syria now, increasingly seen as siding with the people against the dictatorship. Not true in Bahrain, not true in a few other places, but still, no one can look at the U.S. position and say with seriousness they don't want any change at all. You might be able to... You might have been able to say that before, but not now. So the traditional sort of anti-American narrative has been dealt a very serious blow. If we were perceived as blocking a reasonable request by Palestinians at the UN because of our own domestic political structure and an obsessive attachment to anything and everything that Israel may ever want, no matter how unreasonable, including continuing the occupation indefinitely and expanding settlements willy-nilly wherever and however it might be perceived, this could really reverse that. And that would be a very, very serious blow, I think, to the U.S. in the sense it would reverse an exceptionally important gain that we've been able to make, among other costs. And of course, there's a security potential security crisis for Israel if there is an uprising and a major, you know, sort of explosion of anger, and for Palestinians, all kinds of problems as well. So all parties, I think, are poised to lose if there is a serious confrontation, which is why I think it's very, very important that we look for a compromise. And whatever happens, even if there is a confrontation, a soft landing, which would be secured by continuing and even expanding funding for institution building and for the security services, so that the day after, and in October and November and December, Palestinians look around and say, well, either we had a failure at the UN, or we had what we thought was a success in a moment of euphoria, but then we realized it was virtual. But still, you know, there are jobs, things are expanding, things are improving, there's hope, at least on the ground. At least we're answering the settlements by stuff we're doing on the ground, and we'll work to get back to negotiation. Otherwise, you're going to face the people who have played their last card and are sitting there saying, well, we're still, you know, absolutely powerless and under the rule of a foreign army that is just continuing to bring in more colonists, and we're losing, our country is being devoured as we speak. Yes.
We've sort of overstayed our time, I think.
Okay.
Dr. Michael Thomas, Dr. Hussein Ibish, thank you so very much. Your thoughts
thank
and insights
you.
Have been wonderful. My name is Garrett Wong. I'm the board chair of the Alaska World Affairs Council, and I just want to take a few minutes here for some items of business, the first of which is to provide some real Alaska World Affairs Council collectibles to our speakers. So, Dr. Ibish,
we
have a book provided by Top Communications, which is a photo memorabilia of the city.
Thank you very
so
much.
Please enjoy that.
I certainly will. Thank you.
And then, of course, we have the world-famous Alaska World Affairs Council coffee mug here for Dr. Michael.
I'll have to do with my own family album on the Anchorage photo.
So please do. Please enjoy. And for our recognition of our new partnership with the University of Alaska, Dr. Tom Case, please, General, accept this coffee mug in memorabilia of our new partnership. Thank you. And one real quick comment into support of Tom Case's comments. These are the blue cards he's referring to, in case you didn't know which blue cards we're talking about. And if you really like the perspective that the World Affairs Council is bringing to you, these global thoughts, the complexities of the global complex that we face makes the U.S. domestic problems almost non-consequential. But please, we are a membership-supported organization. In order for us to keep doing this in the upcoming years and months, we need your support and underwriting. So please, give us some thought, fill out the forms, and we'll get back to you. And to wrap things up here, I'd like to recognize Brian Davis. Brian, would you come to the podium, please? Now, Brian's been one of these extraordinary board members who's been around for, like, forever. And he, not only has he been around forever, he's been the president of the board twice. So, Brian, on behalf of the board and the members of the Alaska World Affairs Council, we'd like to hand you this Director Emeritus Certificate for all your fine work over these decades. Thank you, Brian. And finally, to wrap things up a little bit here, there are these survey sheets, and if you're inclined to give us your comments about how we might improve the program or your thoughts about what we've done, please share them with us on this and hand it out to the back table. And as we wrap up, for our next program, in case you're wondering, it's next week Friday. That's the September 16th meeting, and it'll be Ambassador Charles Snyder. And he's going to be talking about what the State Department is doing about the war on drugs. interesting issue. So it's, the topic is going to be drugs and thugs. So please join us next week. And to finally say, it would be helpful to us as we move forward if you would RSVP so that we know how many lunches to make available for you. And with that, thank you for joining us today. We'll see you next week.